welcome to the Supertone Show.
Supertone.
The show is co-hosted by The Voice, which belongs to Simon Campbell, and myself, Susie Starlight, and we run a vintage residential recording studio in Estavayer, which is in Valencia, Spain.
I am The Voice.
On today's show, he's a legendary engineer and record producer.
That's not me.
He worked in the music business for nearly 50 years. He designed the 8-track console, which modernised the recording industry. So he's a pioneer in the studio, both musically and technically. And he was also known as the secret weapon behind Timeless Records.
Holy moly.
Who is it?
Who is it?
Tom Dowd.
Not Tom Cruise.
No, Dowd.
All right. Well, tell me what I
Ray Charles.
What do you say? Do it feel all right, baby?
I love Ray Charles.
Well, so do I. It's incredible.
Makes me laugh.
It pops out the speakers. It comes out like a motherfucker and goes, in your eyes. It's fantastic. Hey, baby, won't you be, amazing. And what a piano player. The old Wurlitzer. All recorded at the same time by Tom Dowd. He wasn't really producing at this stage. He was just recording, wasn't he?
Yeah. Beautifully recording.
Well, beautifully recorded. He started recording in 1947. Just after the war. Incredible. It's the first time in the studio. Anyway, that's an Atlantic Records production for Ray Charles. It was all different in the 60s. Because Tom Dowd, even though he was engineering a lot of these sessions, he was kind of, you would call him these days, a producer. His producer over the top, who used to deal with all the budgetary stuff, wasn't it? It was like...
That'd be Jerry Wexler.
Yeah, Jerry Wexler.
That's a hit.
It's a hit. Print it. That's a quote. We'll bring that later on. Yeah, that's Jerry Wexler. It's a hit. Print it. But it's but just going back to Tom Dowd, that was recorded upstairs in the office of Atlantic Records. It was office during the day and the studio at night.
See,
you know, and they used to get these incredible musicians just piling up there. It was about the sixth or seventh floor. If you look at it, we saw recently. Watch the DVD, the Tom Dowd DVD, which is, again, it's a must
The Language
watch.
Of Music.
The Language of Love.
It's music.
Sorry.
You keep saying that.
The Language of Music. Well, anyways, it's Language of Music. Great DVD. Get it. Independent production. It won a few awards, actually. It's,
yeah.
It's really,
I'll tell you
really
what
good.
I really liked about the video and also about Tom Dowd is he documents, in a way, all of the technological innovations and was part of the creation of that from sort of the 40s through, from recording onto vinyl, as in the disc, through to quarter-inch tape.
They cut the master.
But he was there along the whole process and part of the whole creative process. So that's why it's great that we can do the show to sort of, you know, play some of the songs and of the bands and musicians that he's worked with.
Yeah.
Because he was always pioneering and pushing technology and the sound changed.
I was allowed
changed.
To do so.
Yes.
By Armut, wasn't it, from Atlantic Records?
Yeah.
And anyway, we're going to talk about
yes.
that later on.
We digress.
But anyway, just going back to Ray Charles.
Yes, the man.
In the video, he says, what does he say, baby?
He said, you got to always remember that the name of the game is what does it sound like? I can't do an American accent. That's always the image. He says, I don't care if you've got 90 tracks, what does it sound like, baby?
That's what he said. Yeah, but you can't do it like Ray Charles.
I know, I can't. Nobody can.
Well, you're not black.
No.
You know, sort of,
I'm not American.
Yeah, and you're not Ray Charles.
And I'm not Ray Charles.
But it was incredible. He goes, yeah, and that's all that matters, baby. What does it sound like, baby?
Yeah. And I like that.
And the great thing is that, you know, Ray Charles is blind, of course. So, you know, he's got to listen to it. And Tom Dowd was saying that he learned so much from these partially sighted and blind musicians, sax players, clarinetists, and piano players.
Yeah.
Because it got him to focus on listening to the fucking thing.
He didn't use his eyes to listen.
That's right. So, you know, it's and that is, you know, it's a big mantra of ours here with Pro Tools, the enemy. The enemy of fucking making music, Pro Tools, looking at the screen.
Using your eyes to listen instead of listening.
That's right.
Yeah.
And these guys didn't. They used to listen because they couldn't do anything else. They had a few VU meters and then they used to stick their head up to see what was happening in the studio with all these rampantly talented, crazy musicians going apeshit out there.
Yeah.
You know,
and
you've got
raw.
A few knobs.
It
to
was swim. Hot. It was happening.
Anyway, Ray Charles, and what do you say? Just one thing about that record, it was Tom Dowd that actually suggested he put it on both sides of a single because it was so long. It was too long for a standard single. And I think they stopped the track, and then those backing singers came in, hey, what is say, and all that. And they kicked it up again, and they stuck it on the other side. So that was Tom Dowd being creative, you know?
There are no rules.
There are no rules. There certainly weren't then. Anyway... something completely different.
The sound of Jean Coltrane and Nim.
You've got a shit French accent, darling.
I know. I need help. Yeah, Jean Coltrane, beautifully legendary genius.
Well, he was.
Player.
Absolutely musician. Transformed jazz music, you know?
Yeah.
Probably him and Miles Davis. And I'm tricky drowned here because there are going to be lots of jazz people listening to this. So
yeah.
I'm likely to be attacked in the street in Valencia saying, ah, you know nothing, Simon Campbell. You're an asshole. But in my opinion, anyway, Miles Davis and John Coltrane were, you know, they'd really transformed jazz. But again, this was done upstairs in Atlantic Records.
Yeah.
There's some amazing stories. Again, going back to that DVD about Tom Dowd actually recording these guys, like Coltrane. And he was saying, what was it about Coltrane warming up or something for 2 hours?
Yeah, he used to come in 2 hours before the session and just stand there in the corner, just warming up scales, improvising, so that he was literally on fire. So when they actually got to record, Tom Dowd in the video is saying, everybody, we had to be on their toes. It literally... because anything could happen. It was a spontaneous musical performance. So you just had to be on it.
And the thing is, I mean, you know, me now on the other side of the glass sort of more than I have been, capturing that performance, you know. And that was one thing that I've always done. I've always left, well, Pro Tools running or the tape running, because the worst thing you can do is turn the fucking thing off and miss something, you know? Yeah. And, you know, I'm not going to go into the Larry Carlton story this episode. I'll do it in a future episode, but it's a very funny story about Larry Carlton. And the engineer is recording at the time. But anyway, we won't go into that today. We will talk about Tom Dowd. But back to Coltrane. So John Coltrane's there playing his sax with these amazing musicians. And apparently there used to be musicians just hanging about all the time. And they'd just like ring up at like 12 o'clock and they'd say, we're in town, we're going to come and record. So they'd rock up there either after a show or before a show or at 10, 12 o'clock at night and just put it down. And he had to be ready at all times, Tom, because he was actually working as an engineer principally. And of course, Atlantic Records were on the cutting edge of black music recording.
Yeah.
Because they treated it as a niche. And what was his Armut saying? He was saying something like that every time that they recorded a track, or most tracks that they recorded with a black artist, they would get a call to record the same track with a white artist.
That's right.
Because they couldn't sell the black music.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
And I think Tom was recording both sessions for the two different artists for the same song.
Yeah, that's right. They get
two different markets.
Yeah. So Tom would whip over to the other studio, like one of the competitors. You know, it unbelievable, this, you know? Because it's very easy now in 2016 to ignore, you know, what happened in the late 50s and 60s with the racial divide and, you know, what was going on with race. Because they used to call black music race music, didn't they, baby?
Yeah.
I mean, it's disgusting, you know? Unbelievable. Anyway, and it was it Wexler who... Jerry Wexler, who was ended up working for Atlantic Records as executive producer, and then I think he was the leader of it.
Well, it was Wexler that was credited for coining the term rhythm and blues.
That's right, as opposed to race music.
Race records, yeah.
Yeah, race records, yeah.
Yeah.
Incredible. Anyway, so the final thing about him recording jazz was that he got these two bands in. There's so much information about him, it's impossible to remember everything. It's vast, you know, his history. But he had these two amazing jazz bands in. And the recording, it was an idea to record simultaneously.
Mm.
So they had two sets of musicians and they used one set of mics, or one on one set of them, one on one side and one on the other. And this session was going so well, they were starting to run out of tape. And the producer looked down to his horror and the tape was running out. So Tom got another machine fired up and started to record the end of the first section, and then changed the tape on the other machine, swapped over to the machine. So he managed to capture the whole performance, even though it was like 28 minutes long, which was unheard of,
yeah,
you know, in those days. But he managed to capture everything.
He was a cool cookie, wasn't he?
Well, he was.
And that was the time as well, I think, when they were recording all the jazz sessions in stereo, because it only cost like the price of another reel of tape. This is what I love about the technology.
Yeah.
And
the reason why it was another reel of tape is that the Armut from Atlantic Records always insisted right at the beginning that either they cut it onto disc as well as tape, because they didn't trust tape, or if they're doing it on stereo, they had to do it in mono as well, just in case that you didn't trust it. But they had it all in stereo, didn't they?
Yeah, and that was before stereo discs were actually invented.
Yeah.
So when they did come out, they had true stereo. I think they were the only, or one of the few, if only, companies that actually had true stereo recordings, because a lot of people were putting out fake stereo.
Mm. So the Dowdmeister was, you know, the master. Oh, well, he was the master. He was it.
Yeah.
And the great thing about that organisation, Atlantic, though, is that they allowed him. They gave him the money and the freedom to be able to introduce these new things.
Yeah, I think it was quite forceful. Could you see from the video just saying, well, you need this?
But to pay for it. People have got to have vision, you know,
yeah,
to pay for it. So it's easy to come up with the ideas and people say, oh, well, we're not going to do that. You know, that's what happens now in corporations. But then, you know, they had one man in charge or two men in charge and they said, right, okay, yeah, let's do it, man. Let's do it. We've got no money, but we're going to do it anyway. Let's go on to the next track. One of your mum's favourites, I believe.
Well, Saturday night at 8 o'clock, I know where I'm gonna go. I'm gonna pick my baby up and take her to the picture show. Everybody in the neighborhood is dressing up to be there too. Like we always do.
Saturday night,
see. When you're hugging with your baby, last row in the balcony. Well, there's Technicolor and the CinemaScope, a cast out of Hollywood, and the popcorn from the candy stand makes it all seem twice as good. There's always lots of pretty girls with figures they don't try to hide, but they never can compare to the girl sitting by my side.
Saturday night at the movies, who cares what picture you see?
When you're hugging with your baby, last row in the balcony. When you're hugging with your baby, let's row in a balcony.
Saturday night at the movies, who cares what picture you see?
When you're hugging with your baby, let's row in a balcony.
It's the Drifters and Saturday Night at the Movies. I used to dance with my mum in the living room to this song.
Well, it's, you know, a great song.
She used to do the chicken dance to it.
The chicken?
Yeah, she used to.
You can't see her, but she's acting like she's making it like a
like
chicken.
Like a funky chicken.
From the era of amazing songs. Saturday Night at the Movies, great lyric.
It's timeless,
great vocal,
that song.
You know, all in tune. Just a magnificent recording. And the interesting thing is, I believe that these sessions were done with the first multi-channel mixer. In the fact here, what they could do is actually, you know, they were able to turn the bass up later on, which was completely revolutionary, wasn't it?
Yeah, because Tom Dowd was saying that, you know, hearing the bass was critical to making a hit record, which I think is fantastic,
well,
being
is.
A bass player.
Well, it is, but it does get, he's absolutely right. It does give the movement to,
yeah,
you know, the music. You listen to all the stuff that was coming out of Stax later on, you know, with Duck Dunn and all these dudes, you know.
I love the Duck.
Yeah, and it was driving, like James Jameson, all driving the shit, you know, with the bass. But there you are, you know.
What an era to be working in with these glorious musicians.
Yeah. What I didn't know about Tom Dowd is that he, of course, nicked the idea of multi-track recording from Les Paul.
Yeah.
Because Les Paul, of course, invented it, really. He was like the first guy that used it. And it was Tom Dowd that heard Les Paul and Mary Ford's recordings, went down to meet him, and saw this multi-track machine and instantly got a copy of it made.
Yeah.
So he got a copy of it made, and he was using multi-track recording in the late 50s. Now, of course, George Martin and all the guys in England had three tracks, I think, in the mid-60s and four tracks towards the end of the 60s or the late 60s. And, you know, we were so, in England, we were so far behind.
Yeah.
You know? And he built this console with limiters in and EQ and stuff, just something that was completely, you know, mesmerizing. Must have been like science fiction then.
Yeah.
You know, what was going on? It's like now, you know, when you stick a box on a wall and be able to stream a video, you know, off the internet, something without any, you know, wires or anything. It's incredible.
This is great, really. He was in a great position, Tom Dowd, because nobody could tell him what to do because nobody knew what he was doing.
I mean, that's right. Yeah.
What a great... He's like this mad professor coming in. You can imagine him a bit like a technical animal from like the Muppets, you know, that he just have his head under a console and some of these wires and things coming out and going, oh, we need this, turning these knobs and things and just going, right, okay, this doesn't work.
Well,
do
I think
again.
You're completely right, you know, because he was a real troubleshooter as well, wasn't he? We're going to talk about it a bit later on, you know, a troubleshooter for Atlantic. But anyway, let's move on to a completely different style now. ¶¶
give you my love. The light shining through on you.
Yes, I'm with you, my love. It's the morning, just we two.
I'll stay with you, darling, now. I'll stay with you till my seas are dried up. I've been waiting so long to be where I'm going, in the sunshine of your love.
Sunshine of Your Love. I have a question. What was so incredible about Cream at that point in 1967? Why did they ignite the world?
I think it was the first British rock supergroup. In fact, it was the first British rock supergroup because it came right out of the blues explosion a couple of years before.
Yeah.
Eric Clapton, and this is at the time when people were scrolling on walls in London, Clapton is God, you know.
Yeah, and he was. I've read about that.
Yeah, and he was, you know, he was the British saviour of guitar. You know, whether he was or not is a moot point because, of course, there were Peter Green out there and Jeff Beck and Page and all these people that were absolutely fabulous. But he really, you know, he was almost worshipped in England. And
yeah.
Then, of course, he went to see Jimi Hendrix. And that story where him and Beck and Jimmy Page were all sat in the audience, they all went home mumbling about, you know, saying, "Well, it's amazing, you know, it's incredible. What we're going to do now," sort of thing, you know. Henry. Anyway, that's completely off the subject. But what happened here is that I think Armut from Atlantic Records saw Clapton or saw Cream in London, and when they were on their US tour, he said we should record them. So Tom Dowd had never heard of these guys before. Because, of course, if you listen to the music he'd been doing, it wasn't really rock, you know. There's a lot. He'd done a lot of stuff. It was more, you know, jazz and soul and funk and early R&B and stuff. And he was doing that. And all of a sudden, these guys rocked up. And apparently they rocked up with all these Marshall double stacks and fearsome volumes, you know, 100-watt amps in the studio, in this little office upstairs. He didn't know what to make of it at all. And it was produced by Felix Pappalardi from Mountain, Although Sunshine of Love, and the reason why we've played this track is the fact that he, it was Tom Dowd that suggested the drum beat in this, because they really were struggling with this song, and it was the only song out of the album that they were struggling with, and he suggested they used more of a Native American beat, that sort of a much more tribal sort of beat to the groove, and it worked. And there we are, Sunshine of Love.
So Disraeli Gears recording in 3.5 days. Addy Austin, a limo. He had the tapes, sent them through a week later, and then that album just completely exploded in the UK.
Yeah, but again, it's one of those albums that is a total and utter classic of British rock, you know, because it has all those Tales of Brave Ulysses on it, and all those great songs, you know, from that period. And of course, they all hated each other. Jack Bruce and Ginger Baker hated each other, and Ginger Baker hates Jack Bruce, you know, to this day, because he made all the money off the record, because Sunshine of Love he wrote along with a lyricist. But anyway, we digress slightly, because we're talking about Tom Dowd today, but Tom Dowd was the man who captured that performance.
Bravo.
Yeah, bravo. And all that. I can't imagine what he thought when that 100-watt Marshall started firing.
Earplugs.
Yeah, and and his mics. I bet he was using all really cool ribbon mics and stuff, and I bet his meters were like curling over the ends of the stops. Anyway, there we go. Fantastic. John Snow. Now for something completely different.
There's an old friend that I once heard say something that touched my heart, and it began this way. And just like the river, I've been running ever since. He said it's been a long time coming, but I know my change is gonna come. I'm
The mighty Aretha Franklin, and a change is gonna come.
She loved working with Tom Dowd because she said that he was like so musical and he understood what she wanted, you know?
Yeah.
And the reason, well, obviously it's a great song written by Sam Cooke. Aretha Franklin sang and played piano simultaneously. And, of course, they had the whole band in there at the same time. Now, I think if you're an engineer or a producer, you would rather tear your own head off and eat it with the well, I suppose, I don't have a stump of a neck. But anyway, you'd rather tear your own head off rather than do that because it's a nightmare. Because, you know, you've got leakage. You've got the piano leaking at the vocal mic. You've got the movement. You've got the sound of the piano keys. You've got the foot pedals. And then you've got the full band in the background. You know, I bet, you know. But I don't think he was fazed by it because I think that was the norm then. That's what they did. But now, you know, you think, oh, do you really want to sing and play the piano at the same time? You know.
Yeah.
Of course, we do it here because we're into that sort of stuff. I don't really care about Bleed too much. And he obviously doesn't. But it's, you know, when you listen to that voice, though, the power, you know, I bet it was more of a problem, the vocal going at the piano mic than the other way around. Anyway.
But he did say with Aretha as well that she never, ever sang a duff note. You give her anything, sing anything. Mm-hmm. And I think they recorded the album when her first single just exploded. So in those days, as it put a single out, and then it was, you know, get the album recorded ASAP.
Well, what did Wexler say? Because the thing is with Tom, as we said before, he's a bit of a troubleshooter, and he used to go out and sort problems out. And apparently the output of Stax Records in Memphis had stopped for about a month?
Was it a month or two? Because the machine had broken and
they didn't
really have a maintenance program of such down there.
Yeah, And of course, Atlantic were distributing the Stax records. And Wexler got on the phone to Tom and said, go down there and sort it out. Anyway, he went down there and apparently the mixer wasn't working. The multitrack machine wasn't working. So he fixed it because he was an ace repairman, being an ex-physicist, you know.
Yeah.
Well, are you always a physicist when you're a physicist? Probably you are a physicist. But anyway, he was a physicist. So he fixed it and got it all fired up again. And I think on those sessions, he recorded that track.
Oh, it was Rufus Thomas. Walking the dog. That was right, because he was driving past and he saw a load of cars outside the studio. He thought, oh, shit, the studio must be working again. And so he popped his head in and said, I got this little two-minute song. Ran through it a couple of times. He recorded it. And then Tom gave it to Jerry when he came back and he heard it. He went, that's a hit. Print it. Because the dog apparently was like this dance style of dance, so yeah. It had all different kind of dog themed songs.
Well, it's but I mean, it was so spontaneous then, yeah. You know. And you said about Aretha, you know, as soon as a record had come out as a hit, they used to pile in there and just do an album immediately, you know.
It's like Booker T and the MGs were down there, loads of people were just hanging out there, just going.
Well, Booker T and the MGs were the house band for Stax, and that's how Steve Cropper, Duck Dunn, and all those guys actually, you know, ended up working on all those records and writing a lot of them, co-writing a lot.
That's because when Tom went down to fix the machine, he met Cropper and they ended up being buddies. And then sort of like Tom spent his time going around to people's houses having dinner and stuff. And that's how they all kind of bonded.
So not only is a great engineer who could understand the way things should sound with very limited equipment. Secondly, he was like a maintenance man and a design engineer. So he designed these consoles with limited EQ. He helped to design the 8-track console with Ampex. And then, you know, he actually designed or came up with the idea for the fader, the sliding fader.
Yeah.
Because before they had knobs, they had just rotary knobs.
Bakelite knobs,
and he said it was difficult to try and move everything with these Bakelite knobs. So he found a company that actually did the sliders. So he was the man that's responsible for the fucking slider.
And here's a nice connection as well, because he's obviously inventing the sliding faders, but it was because he was a pianist and he wanted to be able to move all the faders two hands. So he played the console like a piano. And well, then you've got Lamoir doing exactly the same thing as a performance mixer.
Yeah. But most mix engineers that I've seen, the old school ones anyway, always they always ride the vocal fader. We had we were very fortunate to spend an afternoon with George Massenberg 2 or 3 weeks ago. Berkeley.
Man.
Yeah, at Berkeley College of Music in Valencia here. What a lovely bloke. Great yeah. bloke, you know. And he was doing a mix, and we were sat in, and he always rides the vocal, if not other. He always likes everything on a fader. Even if it's digital, he has everything on faders, and he likes to ride those faders live, you know, each time. So each time is different. So he doesn't do it all in the box. He might do all the EQ in the box. He might do the equalization, the compression in the box. I'm not a big fan, but he is, and he's George Massenberg, so who am I to argue? But he always rides the faders, which is fantastic, and certainly the lead vocal, which yeah. I thought was great.
I like that, though, because when I see you do that here in the control room, you react to the feel of it, and that's what makes it organic, and I think that's an important factor in making music feel alive. That's my personal experience.
Well, absolutely. Well, in 2 weeks, we've got the mighty Revelators recording here. We're going to do an album all live,
that's
and then we're going to
exciting.
Mix it in a week.
See?
Right? We're going to do that. And then, so we're going to mix it, and we're all going to do it live. So there's going to be four of us on the console. So we're going to have people switching in auxes to get echoes and reverbs going. It's going to be fantastic. It's like an orchestration. You need a baton. I've got to get a baton and tap it and go, okay,
See?
People, are you ready?
Yeah, can't wait.
It's fantastic. Anyway, on with the next track.
Wilson Pickett in the Midnight Hour.
I still love it. I said I loved it before the track. I listened to it again, and I still love it. It's an amazing song. The Stax Boys, of course. Donald Duck there, giving it some duck. And the Colonel, Cropper, skanking it out. Chunk on the two and the four, on the backbeat. Which is one thing about Stax, that they changed the sound of music because they accented the two and four, that backbeat, and Cropper's renowned for it. And they changed that groove from bum click to chick, chick. And it really, you know, amazing. Amazing sound, amazing groove. And people always play that song too fucking fast.
Yeah.
If you go out and see somebody play it live or whatever, everybody plays it too fast. You know why? Because they haven't got the fucking groove. The groove, the custodian of groove, the bass player, You know, the ones that you see, they just don't have it because it's slow. I'm gonna wait to the, it's groovy. Yeah. And it's slow.
I find that a lot, though. In fact, with the bass side of things, you know, when you actually listen to the originals, that's really where a lot of the groove lies, especially from this era, is in the tempo.
Yeah.
And it's lost when I hear other people playing it because it's too fast. And it's like, come on, slow it down. Well, get it into that pocket.
Yeah, they want to try and make it too... They think that speeding it up is going to make it more exciting, which actually it's not because it doesn't get you moving. It doesn't get your hips going. It doesn't get you moving. You know?
And there's that tempo as well that I find sometimes when I've been jamming with other bands. Is that if the drummer goes a little bit too fast, there's a pocket for the bounce for the bass. And it's quite a subtle tempo because I need to bounce. And if I can't bounce because there's not enough space given to me, then the groove's not there.
That's right.
And it's really like frustrating because it is like this mojo place. And when you get it though, it grips you and you're off.
Well,
grin.
Well, that's right. And that's why the Stax guys, you know, Booker T and the MGs, Dirk and all these guys really had it because they really understood that groove and that tempo.
Yeah.
And again, this came out of the Stax studio in Memphis. Tom Dowd, you know, was involved in many of these recordings. Mm. And it's just wonderful stuff.
Was it Stuart? Jim Stewart.
He was a studio manager.
He's a studio manager. Well, I read a story about
I think he's known as the producer on a lot of these records, even though he's more of it's an executive producer role, I think, rather than, as we said before, you know?
Yeah. Oh, okay. Because I just read the story about to finance the actual buying of their tape machine, his sister remortgaged a house, Estrell.
Is that right?
Yeah. So isn't that, I mean, that is an absolute commitment. It's not just like, oh yeah, we've got this, you know, you might have other companies in big cities sort of raising capital that in different ways, but yeah, that situation, it was a bit of investment and putting your house at risk in the sense of remortgaging.
Yeah, of course. But you know, that's what entrepreneurs do, and I think
taking risks.
Yeah. And these smaller labels like Atlantic, when they started off, I mean, they started off with no money. They built it all up by getting artists and, you know, and selling records. But they were constantly reinvesting it in technology because Tom Dowd was trying to push them, you know, to get bigger and better machines and, you know.
It's just always easy to look back and go, oh, you know, when people have made it and they've got a profile and you go, oh, yes, and you can look back at the golden era. But actually, if it was now and you thought, right, tomorrow we're going to remortgage because we need to buy this, you know, you've really got to believe in what you're doing.
We'll be right back.
Eric and the Dominoes. Layla. Classic.
Total.
I think that was one of the first songs that I kind of connected with on with Clapton, was that song. I think a lot of people did as well.
Yeah, because, I mean, it was, you know, his songwriting up to the end of Cream, really, it was very blues-based. You know, and he's a blues man, of course, Clapton. But you know, with Derek and the Dominoes, he sort of went outside that and he started to do something, you know, quite different. And he wrote that with Duane Allman, of course, who plays slide guitar on it. Again, from that video or the DVD, Tom Dow talks extensively about this session, of course, and actually does some demonstrations of the mixing of it, actually, between the two guitars. And also the piano, the grand piano that was used on it, which is down at Criterion Studios in Florida. He says the greatest piano he's ever recorded. And he loves that piano. You know, it's there and, you know, people are playing it. It's fantastic. You know, it really is an awesome thing. And Eric was going through some personal problems then, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think it's well documented that he was developing quite a healthy drink and drug problem at the time.
Or unhealthy.
Yeah. And he rocked up at the studio and he didn't really have a direction, and all he knew is that he had this burning desire to sort of create music. And I think Tom stepped in and really helped him through the recording process and gave some structure and got an album out of Eric at the time. And I think that's why he came to see Tom Dowd as a bit of a father figure, because he trusted him.
Mm. Well, a lot of musicians over the years have trusted him, you know. It's he seems to have done that, very nurturing individual, you know. Because he's a musician himself, and I think that's very important when you, as a producer and engineer, you've got to know what you're talking about. And again, referring to the video, you see him saying somebody's guitar's out of tune, and so that, you know, you need
that
to tune it up.
Yeah.
You need to tune it up a little
you're
bit.
Flat.
You know? You're flat. And he was quite forceful, you know, but very enthusiastic, a massive amount of enthusiasm in the studio, but quite fierce. His direction was quite fierce, you know. And that's what probably Eric needed at the time, because he, you know, he had no direction. And then there's that great story of about him, how he sees Duane Allman.
That's right, because Duane Allman called up Tom Dowd and said that they were playing and that he wanted to meet Eric. But what he didn't know is that Tom had snuck Eric and the guys in backstage when they were playing, and they crept in at the front of the pit. And in the middle of a solo, Duane Allman looks down and there's Eric Clapton staring up at him. And he just freezes. He stops his solo because he's like,
is God,
what the fuck? That's Eric Clapton down there. That's like one of my heroes. Like, so, yeah. So apparently they were both like real big fans of each other, and they kind of learned each other's licks. And so they were up to like, they were up all night when they first met, just chatting and playing and exchanging licks and going, no, that's my lick, you Nick. No, this is how you do it. Mm. And I think the beautiful thing about Duane and Eric is that they really were fans of each other, but when they met in person, there was something more. They got on so well, and they weren't competing against each other. They were really on a good level. There's some magic that happened between them.
Well, you know, it is an incredible track. You know, I have to say now that I think some of Duane Allman's slide guitar is a touch pitchy. But anyway, it's an amazing record, and when you see the DVD, you see the him actually doing a mix of it. You know, you pull up the guitars, and it's really interesting to see him doing that. You know, and of course that piano bit at the end, which apparently is the best piano, he says anyway, that he's ever recorded down in Criteria Studios in Florida. But Tom Dowd over the years has done so many records, and we can't barely scratch the surface of what he's done in this show, because it would be here for 2 days. You know, he's done hundreds of albums.
I think they said that when any one time he'd be in, what was it, all the M's, he'd either be in Miami, Memphis, Muscle Shoals or something.
Yeah,
so
right,
he was always just totally working all the time, a complete and utter workaholic.
Yeah, that's right.
And any time he'd finish the session, if someone came in at like 2 a.m, he'd still do it. He was just so giving, wasn't he? And just so into it, really. And I love that about him. He worked his arse off.
He did. There's something notably missing from this show is any Allman Brothers, because I've got to say, I'm not a great fan. I can hear the Americans going, "Oh my God, what's happening?" You know, but I'm not a massive fan. I love Jessica and some of the other stuff, but I didn't really get it, you know. Mm. Of course, this, you know, Layla, Dwayne was all over it. And the band is a great band, you know, when you see them live. But there's nothing that actually got me. Probably because I'm English. I think the Allman Brothers are a very American band.
It's that Southern feel, isn't it? And that genre of music, which I think
really,
Tom's
we didn't
helped.
Get them in England. It wasn't as much a thing for us in England, you know, as it was in the States. Of course, he did work a lot with Eric Clapton, this Tom Dowd, of course, later on, and produced one of our favourite records, blues records of all time. EC was here.
Great record.
With the mighty Carl Radle.
Great bass lines.
Wow, amazing.
Dancing. Oldacre, yeah, amazing.
Oldacre, George Terry on guitar. Fantastic record, you know. Mm. And what I do like about him as well is his ability to leave mistakes in, you know, because, you know, some of those tracks on EC Was Here, there are mistakes. Eric, you know, makes a right clanger in Have You Ever Loved a Woman, you know. He plays a semitone up, a lick, a semitone out of tune, you know. But does it matter compared with all the amazing stuff he comes out with it before and after it, you know? It's live, for Christ's sake. And he's probably looking at the audience and he's got his hand in the wrong place.
The feel then, really. Magic's where the feel is.
That's right. Home is where the heart is.
Magic is where the feel is. There you go.
But of course, we couldn't speak about Tom Dowd without playing this band.
We love you guys. God bless you. Thank you for supporting Lynyrd Skynyrd. Let's keep it going for another 40 years or so. And hey, Sparky. Turn it up, Atlanta. Thank you.
Lynyrd Skynyrd, Sweet Home Alabama, from One More From the Road, a live double album.
Produced by
Tom
Dowd.
Got a great story about this album, actually. It really made me laugh. It was when they were actually recording this on location, after the first gig or the first night, Tom thought that the band was staying out of town, but they weren't. They were staying in town, and they got into a scrap, into a few fights. And so the way he had to try and get the band not to get into fights after the gigs was that he would always grab some takeout, and they'd go back and listen to the tapes of the recordings together till early in the morning to keep them out of trouble. But it was part of his policy anyway, so that they'd listen to where they were up to know if they'd nailed the songs for the recording, and then they put in the tracks, the other songs that they hadn't recorded, and then he would rehearse them and then record them.
Right.
So he was using that as a technique as well to keep them from getting into fights.
Into bother.
See. So I think he learned that from the Allman Brothers as well. They had they used to do that. They used to go and listen to tapes.
The Southern Boys.
No, I don't know about the scrapping, but I know that he started doing that 2 o'clock in the morning, kind of listening back to that night's live recordings, so that the band would agree with the takes that they were going to use for the actual final cut, and then they put in and say, "Okay, we need to play this song because we haven't actually nailed that one yet." And so
it is interesting.
Full on.
Yeah, it is interesting, like what we were saying before about him liking to record wherever he could, in the fact he, you know, like I said about EC was here before, you know, he likes doing these live albums, he likes producing these live albums, because I think he felt there was a lot of energy there, because of course it was Al Kooper who did the original production of the studio albums, certainly for Sweet Home Alabama and the fearful Freebird, which, you know, I could have played today, gentlemen and ladies, but I don't think it's a good idea.
No.
But it's, you know.
It's a great song, but I think it's nice just to play something different, isn't it?
Well, it is, yeah. And I've got to say something about Freebird, actually. It's one of those songs that when you're a young lad as a guitar player and jamming, right, everybody played Freebird. And I had never played it, ever, as a cover. I don't really do covers. I've only played my own music, really. I haven't done a lot of covers. And when I first moved to the Isle of Man and started playing guitar again, picking the guitar up, I had 10 years off, there's a guy called Matt Collister who I was talking to today, and we were jamming, and he went into Freebird and he started playing it, and I thought, holy fuck, this is the first time I have ever played it, ever. And it's, you know, it's so overplayed, you know.
I think it's because we've heard so many kind of bad versions of it, really, being honest about it.
And open. Sweet Home Alabama as well. That's another one, you know, which I have tried to resist.
It's a few classics being killed, basically.
Oh, yeah. Murdered, screaming in the gutter. No, not again, please. Anyway,
so
Tom Dowd and live recording.
And he was saying, you know, he knew the band, the music, he knew where to put the mics and the arrangements of it, and the musical side of him also really sort of helped with those live album recordings, so...
Yeah,
that's cool.
Because I think recording live is very tricky, you know, because you've got a lot of problems that you don't have in the studio. In those days, of course, they weren't in ears. It was all loud stage monitoring, you know.
Yeah.
So they're all bleeding into the microphones, and it's very tricky to get a rock and roll band to, you know, to sound great.
You know, with the Allman Brothers, when they did the live Fillmore East album, Dowd snuck in the back and he was just in the truck, and they didn't even know he was there, because he knew he was actually just telling the engineer when the guitar solos were coming up, and he got the mic placements, and he got a tap on the shoulder. It was very funny, saying, "You didn't tell me, you know, where to put the mics for the horns." He goes, "What horns?" And he thought this guy was being a smart ass, and then he looked, and there were two horn players and a harp suddenly appeared on stage, right? And he's going, "What the fuck?" And he said, "Well, where do you want me to put this?" And he went, "Shit, just put it on the mic, the vocal mic, channel." Because he said, he didn't give a shit at that point. And he said he went backstage and he said to Dwayne Allman when he came off stage, he said, "You son of a bitch, if you ever do that to me again, those horns are on there, I'm pulling the recording." And they were having none of it. So he marched them back, made them listen to the bloody tape. And then they agreed to fire the horn section when they realised what the horns were playing.
Is that right?
Yeah, because that's the other thing as well. You get, you know, you do a live recording and you think you're miking up these instruments and then suddenly there are other players, different instruments that happen and
we know all about that.
Yeah,
actually.
I was just thinking about this
recently, but we won't go, no names.
No. But we've been there too and it's like, okay, so this is what we do, you know?
Yeah.
But it is a surprise. And this is the other thing, you know, guys do say what instruments are going to be played. It really helps.
It does. And it strikes fear into the heart of the recording engineer and producer when all of a sudden somebody rocks up and they're waving their instrument around and go, in the nicest
way. Oh, hello. Well, you can
by
imagine
a microphone, it which is not meant to be.
At least for us, it wasn't a massive harp.
No, indeed not.
Imagine what Tom Downs saw him. What the fuck is that doing on stage with the Allman Brothers?
Fantastic. Now, in the and I didn't know it at the time, but these guys were produced also by Tom Dowd, and I do have the single, and I bought it on Elektra Records. Roll ending, JoJo Gunn, and Run, Run, Run. Yes, from my early days of listening to music.
I'm astounded because I know that song and I never knew what it was called.
These guys came straight out of the band Spirit when Spirit split up with the colourfully named Randy California. Randy California went off and did his solo thing, and then these guys formed JoJo Gunn. And it's a good pop song, nicely recorded for the 70s, 1972, I think this. You know, I was 14 when I bought this. So, yeah, one of my first records.
That's a good song.
It is a good song, yeah. It's great.
You can kind of hear other songs in it later on.
Yeah.
The other songs that have taken little bits of that one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And slide solo again, you know, so because of course, the Dwayne album, not that much before this, really.
Mm. It felt a little element of Queen in there as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
A very tight drum sound. Yeah, yeah. It's nice. It's a good record. But they are. Tom Dowd produced that.
What a man.
But today, we're going to finish the show with a magnificent produced and recorded song by an English artist. somebody who was very influential at the time. And you know, she has a voice like an angel. I've always loved her. I've always loved this song. So take a listen to this.
Billy Ray was a preacher's son, and when his daddy would visit, he'd come along. When they gathered around and started talking, Cousin Billy would take me walking. Out through the backyard we go walking, then he'd look into my eyes. Lord knows to my surprise, the only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was. He was. Everything is all right. You kiss and tell me everything's all right. Can I get away again tonight? The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man.
Dusty Springfield, great name, son of a preacher man.
Amazing. You know, great lyric, great song, great production. A very furious bass line there. It was all over the place. It was all, you know, giving it plenty. Fabulous. Fabulous song. And that was executive production by Jerry Wexler.
Jerry Wexler?
Yeah. It's a hit, print it.
It's a hit, print it.
Him.
And produced by Tom.
Yeah, yeah, and produced by Tom. But again, a magnificent soundscape, you know, utilising a lot of multi-track techniques there, of course, which he, by then, I don't know, in 68, he was probably using 16-track then or something, or certainly 8 then, you know.
Yeah.
Because he was really striking forward in terms of his techniques and stuff, you know.
It's interesting, you know, when you think about... TV when it first came out and you had the artists on TV, because Tom Dowd was saying that later on the problem with the music industry was that people started to buy things from what they were seeing with the introduction of more videos as opposed to what they were hearing. And it kind of, you know, because I remember Dusty, I remember old footage. I wasn't around really or conscious when she was having that hit, but It's interesting, isn't it? Because image still mattered with the TV, but the songs were good in those days. They were, well, for me, I guess they were proper songs.
Well, exactly. Exactly. And, you know, you can have the arrangement, you can have the sound, you know, but you can't polish shit.
Mm.
All you can do is make it sound better, you know, or sound like it was played.
Do you think we sound a bit dated when we say, you know, because we are sort of, you and I have got this big banner, this sigil that goes, you know, the song, you know, where have the songs gone a lot of the time? I mean, is it a case of now, you know, with a lot of the ambient soundtracks and a lot of music that comes out today, you know, it's not really of that format. There's no particular song there or anything. It's more of a pastel kind of wash as opposed to anything that sort of connects in. And I think that's... Because I've been thinking about this. Is the song still valid? You know, do people still want songs, or do they just want background music?
Ask Adele. You know, I mean, you look at those songs, she and, you know, her co-writers write songs. And it's been those songs that she created on those records have been the biggest hits. You look at now the singer-songwriters out there. There's a lot more singer-songwriters coming back, you know, the popular ones, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not particularly keen on the, you know, the likes of Jake Bugg and stuff. I mean, cool, but they are writing songs, which is beautiful, you know. And you listen to, you know, Ryan Adams and there are still a lot of people in Nashville that are writing great songs.
Because I know Tom Dow was saying, you know, it's really important to have a song. You know, you're sort of 80-90% of the way there if the song's right, you know.
But Jason Isbell, and like, so all these guys that are doing well now, you know, they're still writing songs with lyrics that mean something. And I think a lot of the popular music, the stuff that is disposable music, is the stuff without a song structure. And, you know, we might be dinosaurs. We may be, you know. But we've got a massive bloody old school analog recording console here, and we are old school.
Yeah.
But what we're trying to do here is create something that is, or recreate something that has that beauty and a longevity. Because I still believe that people are not buying music now because the music is not of a sufficient quality. That's what I believe. If people really think it's good, they will still buy it. I know that.
Yeah.
You know, we buy records. We still buy albums. We still buy records. You know, if it's a good record and it's a new record, we will go out and buy it. We'll buy it on vinyl and we'll buy it on CD.
Because it's part, it's an event. We connect in with it.
Yeah. And when we're eating lunch or when we're having dinner or, you know, we're sat down relaxing and we're listening to vinyl, which we do, we turn the record over, we listen to the whole thing. We don't put a track at a time on. It's an experience for us. And you know, we might be old-fashioned and we may be dinosaurs. I don't know, darling.
But you know, the thing is it's our passion and there's no apology for that.
Yeah.
And it's almost, I think, you know, like fashions in terms of you get a 60s fashion coming back in 19, whatever, it goes in cycles. And the thing is that a lot of the time, it's not necessarily the quality, it's the timing, isn't it? Because you can have a great song. It's like, for example, 1999 with Prince.
Mm.
I remember when that came out, I bought it on 7-inch vinyl and it totally gripped me. And I remember I was going out to clubs and it's like, why aren't they playing it? I'd request it, but it didn't chart for another year because the British public did not get it the first time it was released.
Yeah.
And so sometimes it's about timing. It's not the fact that the song is good or bad. It's just timing.
That's right.
It's a bit of like luck or a bit of fairy dust or something.
Well, yeah. But, you know, songs I think are still valid, just to answer your point.
Okay.
And I think that Tom Dowd thought that songs were still valid.
Absolutely.
And I think that some of the great producers that we are featuring on the series and the ones that we listen to still focus completely on the song.
Yeah,
you know,
he's definitely a force to be reckoned with, and I mean, he's inspirational.
He is,
and it's been actually very intense because he's so prolific. It's been hard to try and sift through to try and, you know,
find some tracks and we've tried to get a selection today.
Yeah.
Some jazz. You know, we've done all sorts of different types of styles to try and get an idea.
Yeah,
where he's coming from. You know,
because
people think about
him
from that rock era. You know, when he was doing the Allman Brothers and Clapton and Lynyrd Skynyrd and all that type of band.
Yeah,
you know. And I think we just wanted to give a different flavour. But Tom Dowd, you know, has been responsible, in summary, for, you know, the sliding fader, the multi-track recorder. You know, when he met Sir George Martin in the 60s and found out they were using 3-track and 4-track, and he'd been using 8-track, and he'd been using 4-track since 1958 or something.
So Tom Dowd inspired George Martin and got him to change up his technology,
exactly,
which then had a knock-on effect with the Beatles recordings as well. So this guy and he was a very positive, very gentle man, a psychologist as well with production.
Well, I think as a producer, you've got to be a psychologist. Yeah. That's part of the, you know, to work with Eric Clapton and all these, you know, and all these stars that are coming in. Aretha Franklin, I mean, my God, even then she was a diva, you know. Can you imagine her rocking up in the studio, you know?
Yeah.
With a voice like that, with a massive talent and a huge entourage of musicians and, you know, to deal with that sort of situations, it must be tricky. But, you know, in summary, Tom Dowd, who died, what was it, 2002? Was it something like that?
Yeah, it's a while back
it's
now.
It's a while back, but thank you for all the gifts.
Cheers,
you've given
Tom.
Us. And thank you for listening, because we are doing these regular producer podcasts every month, which I hope you're enjoying. If you want to talk to us, you can send us an email on podcasts@supertonerecords.com.
And we're on Twitter at Simon, Susie and Simon.
That's with a Z.
A Z, S-U-Z-Y.
Susie and Simon.
Yeah,
At Twitter.
And if you want to have a look at the studio, it's supertonerecords.com. We've got a lovely new website, and it's got loads of information on, pictures of the studio and our artists that work here, and a little bit more about what we're about.
Some videos and links to the other podcasts that we've done. But anyway, we would love to see you again, and tune in for the next show.
See.
Hasta luego.
Okay.